Conference record has joined the conference.
Okay, great. I think we've got the recording started, and Arun, I will hand the floor over to you. Thanks for joining us, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you for joining, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. My name is Arun Gupta, and I work for Oracle. And today the topic is Java EE 6 and Glassfish version 3, how it provides a lightweight, extensible, and a powerful platform. As I said, I work for Oracle, and I got a fairly extensive blog on blogs.sun.com/Arun Gupta. I'll be happy to share the slides. I'll pass them on to Vicky, who will then share it with both the Oracle ACE directors and Java champions. And in case you're interested, I'm an active tweeter as well at the handle mentioned on the screen. This is a standard disclaimer that we put in all Oracle slides. The idea is that, you know, do not make a business decision based upon these slides. You know, make sure you contact with somebody who is more responsible at Oracle, not me at least. All right, and in case you are tweeting about today's event, so these are the hashtags that we want to encourage you to use, and we definitely encourage you to tweet about it. You know, it's all about viral. All right, so just have a look at the kind of history a little bit of where Java EE has gone over a period of time. You know, we have had multiple releases of Java EE, the most recent one being Java EE 6 that was done in December of 2009. Up until then, Java EE 5 was the most recent release, and you can see that the number of vendors who are actually behind Java EE 5 implementations. These are all the compliant implementations. Now, some consolidations have happened, but still, you know, you can see that IBM, Oracle, VEA at that time, Glassfish at that time, Geronimo, all the big vendors have Java EE 5 compliant implementations. Java EE 5 has been a very powerful standard and continues to be so. Now, in terms of Java EE 6, where that takes us is, well, today we have, you know, Glassfish and TMaxsoft are the two compliant application servers. And the final release of TMaxsoft being coming later this year, but there are very clear plans from Oracle WebLogic Suite, JBoss, Caucho, and Geronimo, and other vendors as well, who want to be Java EE 6 compliant. So the key point that I'm trying to convey through the previous and this slide is that Java EE has been a very forceful, powerful industry standard, and will continue to remain so in the future as well. Now, let's get into the deep of it. You know, what really the goals for the Java EE 6 platform were. So I definitely encourage to keep it a completely interactive presentation. So if you have a question, feel free to, you know, stop me. I don't know how, Vicky, how the Q&A kind of work.
It's fine. It's however you decide. If you want people to jump in, that's totally fine with me.
Oh, okay. So they can ask a question on the phone itself?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Just make sure you unmute your phone, but it's just an open line.
Okay, perfect. So, yeah, so then feel free to ask questions anytime you have. We have lots of material to cover. I originally was planning to show a whole bunch of demos, but then I decided, you know, I have a series of 5 screencasts that basically exactly mimic the demos that I typically show. So I would rather not show demos today, and I would refer you to those screencasts. They're about 35 minutes of screencasts. You can just walk through them. Those are the exact demos that I typically show for Java EE 6. I will instead load you with a lot more information on Java EE 6 that is typically not evident from the demos. So that's my goal. So anyway, in terms of the goals of the Java EE 6 platform, now there are 3 big goals. To keep it completely flexible and lightweight. So what that means is, you know, over a period of time, the platform has grown big. I mean, there are 28 specifications that exist in the platform today. It is very powerful, provides a lot of functionality, is very rich, but becomes bulky too. So one of the things that we introduced in Java EE 6 was the concept of pruning. What that means is you identify certain specifications that were relevant when they were introduced, but not anymore. So for example, take an example of JAX-RPC. You know, earlier when the web services were introduced in the Java EE platform, RPC encoded used to be the standard way of doing web services. Not anymore. Similarly, EJB 2.x entity beans, which are being superseded by, you know, JPA now. JAX-R, you know, we did XML-based registries, you know, not very prevalent right now. So the idea is to define a two-step process wherein you identify certain specifications, mark them from pruning now, make them optional in the next release, and either delete them or get them out of the specification in a subsequent release. Gives enough time for the vendors and the customers to understand that these specifications possibly will be removed from a future version of the platform, and still keep the platform lightweight and agile in order to make, you know, progress. That's sort of the lightweight part of it. In terms of extensible, we understand there are a bunch of frameworks that are outside of Java EE, you know, Spring, Struts, Tapestry, Lyft, a bunch of frameworks, which some developers, you know, like to use. So up until now, you had to kind of integrate them as, you know, either your servlet listener or servlet context listener or things like that. You have to put them as part of your application deployment descriptor. Now, Java EE 6 is defining a standard way on how those frameworks can be integrated with a Java EE 6 application. And we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. And the last one is, you know, as the biggest theme around Java EE 5 was ease of development, and we have taken that a step forward in terms of, you know, how we do that in Java EE 6. And a lot of focus of this presentation is going to be on that. So the first step in terms of making the platform flexible and lightweight is we introduced something called as Java EE 6 Web Profile, and the version is 1.0. This is so a profile is either a subset or superset of specifications in the platform, and they're targeted towards a vertical set of developers. The web profile, as the name says, is targeted towards web developers. So this profile was actively discussed in the Java EE 6 expert group and outside it because of the ramifications it has. But otherwise, you can see the set of technologies that were integrated as part of the platform. So, you know, for example, you can see Servlet 3.0, JSP, debugging support for other languages, Java transactions, Java persistence API, and a whole bunch of other specifications. So these specifications together, the idea is, will be enough for you to implement a web application. The GlassFish, which is the reference implementation for Java EE 6, you know, comes in two flavors. There is a web profile version, a web bundle, which is about 45 megabytes. So that means once you download that 45 megabyte bundle, you get all of these specifications, their implementations included as part of the 45 megabyte bundle. So that means you can create a full-blown web application on that 45 megabyte bundle. So that's pretty cool. And of course, there's a full-blown GlassFish download as well. What that means is it has all the specifications that are not part of the web, that are available as part of the Java EE 6 platform. So let's see in terms of Java EE 6, what are the key specifications? We just talked about web profile. There are a bunch of specifications in there. But in terms of Java EE 6, you know, as required by the Java community process, there are really three deliverables. You know, first is the specifications, which is, you know, the Java EE 6 platform, JPA, JSP, you know, that is the paperware in which you have English text written, like, okay, how the technology or the component should behave. Then there is a reference implementation of those specifications, that the paperware is actually implementable. And then you have, you know, yeah, actually you have the code for that implementation. And even though the term is being used as reference implementation, but that does not mean it's only for reference. It's fully ready, you know, as a production quality application server. So you can definitely use it, you know, in production today. And the last piece of deliverable defined by the Java community process is the technology compliance kit, which is basically that, okay, today GlassFish is the Java EE 6 compliant application server, but tomorrow if somebody else wants to have EE 6 compliant app server, what do? They build their server, and then they run the technology compliance kit, and then they pass the compliance kit to get Java EE 6 certification. So this ensures that, you know, anybody who creates a Java EE 6 app server is compliant with the brand. So that's the deal. All of this was completed December of last year. In terms of the specifications, and of course, as I said, there are a whole bunch of specifications, and we'll talk about a majority of them actually in this presentation. The platform is a big specification which basically defines how different technologies, different components need to work with each other, what are the higher level requirements, and how they, you know, basically work with each other. Then the web profile 1.0 is a specification from the Java E6 expert group itself. Now, Java E6 specification defines how the profile needs to be defined, what it needs to look like. But then the web profile is a separate specification which says, okay, we are following that process, and here are the specifications that need to go as part of web profile 1.0. And then there's a managed beans 1.0 specification. This is a new one that is being introduced in the Java EE platform. Think about it as an analogy to, we had Java Bean for SE. This is, you know, Java Beans for EE. It can extend the concept of Java Beans and say there are certain higher level services that are available to all the specifications. So for example, lifecycle callback methods, resource injection, and things like that. There are certain new specifications that are introduced as part of Java EE6. So context and dependency injection for Java EE, which is JSR 299. It defines the type-safe dependency injection mechanism in the Java EE platform, and we'll talk a lot about it in the presentation later today. Bean validation, it defines a predefined set of validation constraints that can be put on your Java beans. So, for example, not null, which says that, okay, make sure that this attribute is not null. And again, we're going to talk about it later in the presentation. Java API for RESTful Web Services, or JAX-RS, or JSR 311, is now part of the platform. When JAX-RS 1.0 was introduced, mainly because of the timing constraints, it could not be included as part of the platform, but now it very well is. And then, finally, dependency injection for Java, which is basically the base for defining JSR 299, is also part of the Java E6 platform. Of these, the CDI, which is the context and dependency injection, and beam validation are produced by Red Hat, actually. Several of the existing specifications in Java E6 got an extreme makeover. So Java Server Faces, Java Servlets, Persistence API, EJB, Connector Architecture, and we'll talk about a bunch of these, you know, in the presentation today, hopefully giving you an idea of what we call extreme makeover about them. And as you would realize, the biggest focus around these is ease of development and configuration over convention over configuration, actually. Several of the other specifications got minor updates, and then there are a whole bunch of other specifications that exist in the platform today. All right, so that's sort of the broader, you know, so to say, 10,000 feet view of Java E6 platform. Now we're going to start digging into each specification and see what makes sense. Okay, so the biggest focus on Java E6 is being ease of development. And the primary focus of ease of development is web tier, because that's where, you know, we realize most of the folks spend their time. So the general principles around ease of development has been heavy usage of annotations to reduce and eliminate the need for deployment descriptor. So for example, one of the big changes that we have done is deployment descriptors like web.xml or Java Server Faces, faces-config.xml are optional in most of the common cases. The idea is that they have now annotation equivalent, so you no longer have to muck around with your deployment descriptors. Instead, you can put that information in your source file itself. Something new that we have introduced in the platform itself is, you know, traditional API for advanced users. So what is it that, like, you know, if you want, for example, to have your servlet being registered dynamically at runtime instead of specified using the deployment descriptor, so that can be done too. And we will talk about that later today. So let's take a look at, you know, how servlets, for example, look like in Java E5. So on the left, what you see is, this is my deployment descriptor. you can see web app, servlet, servlet name, servlet class, mapping, all those things. And then there is my actual Java class. So at least these two files are required to, you know, have servlet being enabled and hosted in a part of your WAR file. So at least you put these two in a WAR file. You drop the WAR file in your web app folder, or, you know, you deploy the WAR file, and then your servlet is ready. see the change. Now, as part of Serverless 3.0, what we have done is, you know, all you need is one source file, and all of your information is easily captured in the @ web servlet annotation. And as you can see, the name attribute is over here. You know, it says name my servlet. And then you have URL patterns where you can specify either one or multiple pattern on where you want the servlet to be hosted. If you look at the corresponding deployment descriptor, which by the way is optional in this case, and if I have to show you just a mapping, then you can see that my comsun package and my class name are mapped over here to the servlet class element. The name itself is mapped to the servlet name attribute in the deployment descriptor. And then the URL patterns is, of course, mapped to servlet mapping. So the idea is, you know, all the elements that you have in web.xml are easily captured in my annotations of the servlet class. So that's the simplicity. Now, it's not just confined to defining your servlet. You know, your advanced concepts. This is another example of web servlet, for example. You can see there is a name. There's a URL pattern, and there are initial parameters that you typically specify in your web.xml. Now, they can be specified as part of your annotation itself. Here's another example. You know, how do you define your servlet listener? Well, this is the typical fragment that you use in the web.xml, and this is how you would define that in your servlet class itself. So you have a login servlet listener, which implements servlet context listener. This code you have to write anyway. All you do is you put the @ web listener annotation, and that's it. And then the mappings are shown very clearly, you know, how the mapping really works. Another new feature that we have introduced in Servlets 3.0 is asynchronous servlets. So typically, think about your server-side resources are very expensive. You know, you don't want a thread to wait while it's processing either a database-bound intensity and activity, which is taking longer time, or some file-bound activity, or some network activity. Now, on the @ web servlet annotation, you can set the attribute called as async supported equals true. So what that means is, while you can explicitly control when the servlet, while the servlet is doing some database-bound or disk-bound activity, I want the servlet to wait. Now, so that the thread is parked. When the activity is completed, the thread is revived, and the response is returned back to the client. So this gives a very high utilization of resources on the server side. In terms of the code, the way it looks like is, you know, this is your, for example, your typical doGet method. So once you receive a request, you can say request.startAsync on the context. You know, that gives you an async context. On the context, you add an async listener. And this async listener has a whole bunch of callback methods, which basically says on timeout, on error, on response, and things like that. And then finally, once you have added the listener, your callback methods are ready. You know, they do what the business logic requires them to do. Then you dispatch either to a JSP, or you can start a runnable action. This could be in a totally separate thread, for example. You know, this is where you want to do your database-bound activity or disk-bound activity. And then finally, once you are done, then you say context.complete, and then your callback methods are being invoked. And the blog URL at the bottom of the screen really shows a fully complete working example of how the whole thing works. I talked briefly about extensibility, so you know, the different frameworks that exist today. So think about it. You know, if you are integrating, for example, Wicket, you know, as part of a Java EE6 application, then you have to take the Wicket framework registration code, put that as part of your application deployment code. So you have your application deployment descriptor, which not only has your application deployment descriptor code, but also your Wicket framework registration code. Now, okay, if you are using another framework, then you have application code, application deployment, framework 1 deployment, framework 2 deployment, and if third, then framework 3 deployment. So it all becomes very convoluted. So you have to add comments and make sure that it understands and you know which portion is what. Now, starting with Servlets 3.0, what we're defining is in the framework.jar file itself, you could have a metainf directory. And in the metainf directory, you have this file called as web-fragment.xml. And in that web-fragment.xml, you define whatever you want to define in terms of framework registration. So you could have servlet context listeners, context paths, everything defined in there. When that information or when that jar is being dropped in a servlet 3.0 compliant container, it'll create a consolidated view of web.xml. It'll look at your web.xml if it needs to or if it has one. It'll scan through the metaimp directory of all the jar files, find out any web-fragment.xml, and then at the runtime, it'll create a consolidated web.xml. So the framework registration will automatically happen. So here is an example. So I wrote a simple application on how to get started with Wicket on Glassfish. And so for example, you can see there is a web-fragment as a very top element and at the bottom. Everything else, which is filter, filter mapping, all of those is very standard web.xml syntax. So nothing new in here, but just this gives you a web.xml, a much more modular view, and the deployment code exists closer to where the source code is. There are a lot more features that are being added in Servlet 3.0 in terms of how you can programmatically authenticate, you can log in, log out, or file upload. A default error page is a very cool one. So for example, up until now you could say, okay, if the error is 404, this is the page I need to display. If the error is 500, this is the page I need to display. But now you can say, you know what, this is a standard error page. Now, okay, I'm catching 1, 2, 3 exceptions or 1, 2, 3 error codes, but if some unknown error happens, then display this error page. So this is, the websites do that, but they have this, that's more in a proprietary way. This is the standard way. All right, switching gears. So let's talk about EJB. Up until now, if you are bundling your EJBs, or if you are deploying your EJBs, you have to bundle them in a jar file called beans.jar. Okay, let's say foo_EJB.jar, and it's got a beans class and a helper class. Then you package it all together with your var file in an ear file. So there's an ear, which has a var and a jar file. Come Java EE 6, at least in EJB 3.1, what we're doing is you can bundle your EJB files in, as part of the var file itself. So for example, you have your foo bean and foo helper files right here, and you got a servlet and your other utility classes here as well, all of them bundled together. And guess what happens to web.xml? It's totally optional at this case. As I mentioned earlier, it's optional in most of the common cases. So in pretty much 85% of the cases, you would not need a web.xml. So it's a very simplified, lightweight packaging model. And how we achieve that, some thought process behind that. So for example, you can take a bean and you can have a no interface view. What that means is, you can take a bean, it's a POJO class, you just put at stateless annotation on it, and that makes it a bean. That's it. You just start adding your business method, say hello and things like that, and that becomes your stateless session bean. So it's very simple, one source file per bean, and that's all it is. We also introduced some lifecycle initialization methods over here. So, for example, a new bean that we've introduced in EJB 3.1, a new type of bean is singleton bean. Now, singleton bean is single instance of bean across VM per app. And on those beans are typically used, for example, caching your data, and you can easily achieve that. Now, on those beans, you can also have lifecycle callback methods, which are like, post construct and pre destroy annotation. So any method in those beans can be marked with those annotations, and those methods can actually be used for initialization and destruction of your resources, for example. Something new that we've introduced in EJB 3.1 is also the portable global JNDI name. Up until now, we only had Java colon comp, the namespace for JNDI. And that's again, app server specific. So your names, JNDI names, are not global, and they're not portable, the most important part. Now, we have a standard syntax on how these JNDI names are defined, that they're derived, they are actually in Java colon global namespace, and then they derive from the application name, the module name, the beam name, the fully qualified class name, and things like that. And those rules are very well defined in the EJB 3.1 specification. Something new that we've introduced in EJB 3.1 is an embeddable API. The embeddable API, you know, runs your full EJB container within a VM. So, for example, look at this code over here. So, I have EJBC, EJB container, colon, EJB container. So, this creates my full-blown EJB container. Then I can get a context, I can look up the beam, and notice how I'm looking in the Java colon global namespace over here. Then I can invoke the bean method, and I can say assert on it, and then I can say ejbcontainer.close, as simple as that. Very huge implications of, you know, how you test your bean. It's very nice and very simple to get it rolling. And this blog actually defines and describes you how to get your EJB container running easily. I talked briefly about singleton beans already. These beans are actually not pooled. I forgot to mention that. And add singleton is the only annotation that we require to make them singleton instances. Something new that we've introduced also in EJB 3.1 is asynchronous session bean. So instead of, you know, your business method returning an integer, it returns a future of integer. A future, as you know, is a very standard API in JDK. So all you do is you get the future object on the client side. You keep polling it on how, you know, whether the result is available or is still working on the result or cancel the request, things like that. So altogether, it gives you a very lightweight JMS solution without the entire JMS infrastructure setup. The URL at the bottom explains in detail on how this asynchronous EJB thing really works. Another big improvement in EJB 3.1 is calendar-based timers. And what that gives you is, you know, cron-like syntax. So, for example, you can, on any arbitrary method, you can have an add schedule annotation. Excuse me. You can have an add schedule annotation, and on the in the add schedule annotation, for example, you can say there are different attributes to it. So, the first example here shows, for example, you can say day of week, Monday and Wednesday, and it takes a default value for hour, minute, time, hour, minute and second. This particular annotation means do some activity on Monday and Wednesday of midnight every week, every month, every year. So the moment you put this annotation on top of a method, then based upon add schedule annotation and the cron syntax specified over there, a timer is automatically created for you. And the timer syntax actually gets fairly complicated. So the second example shows some fragment of that, and it says, okay, every 14th minute within the hour, you know, for the hours 1 and 2 a.m., do certain activity. So you can actually achieve full cron-like semantics for the EJB 3.1 timers. Now, if we recall from the web profile 1.0, we said we have EJB 3.1 in there. Now, instead of having a full-blown EJB 3.1, what we're talking about is EJB 3.1 Lite or EJB Lite. So, and this slide actually highlights the difference between EJB Lite and EJB 3.1. So you can see, you know, it has local session beans, declarative security, transactions, interceptors, and security. But these features over here, you know, backward compatibility, timer surveys, asynchronous method invocations are missing from your EJB Lite. Now, if you are targeting a web application, and I talked about bundling your EJBs in a WAR file, you are only available with features of EJB Lite. All right, switching one more gear, and I'm going to take a quick 15-second break to drink some water. All right, thank you. Now, context and dependency injection, as I said, is a brand new specification that got introduced as part of the platform. What it is provides you is a type-safe mechanism for dependency injection in the platform. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. You know, what does it really mean? How does it provide type-safe dependency injection? But the cool thing is, you know, it comes with expression language resolver. So you declare a CDI bean, so to say, And that CDI beam can actually be used in your Java Server Faces or JSF page. And then the expression language, it comes with the expression language resolver, so the CDI beams can be used there directly. It also defines some new context and scopes. For example, conversation scope, which can go across multiple requests and multiple sessions. So let's try to get some basics of CDI and what does it mean. CDI defines this concept of injection points. So a CDI beam can be injected at a field, at a method, and a constructor. It's a simple beam, but the idea is you can define how the beam needs to be injected, where the beam needs to be injected. Each beam can have zero or more qualifiers, and each beam has a type. So for example, if you look at this statement, it's here it says, at inject, at login, user, user. Now if we try to dissect it, then we'll understand it a little bit better. The first at inject is saying, okay, I'm requesting an injection. So I please inject something in this statement. And then it says, what type? So, okay, please inject a user in this type. And the variable being the user with small u. And then we are also saying, okay, I care about logged in user only. So somewhere in your application, you have a user bean, and then the user bean can have, or a user interface, so to say, this user could have multiple implementations. One of those implementations is possibly tagged as logged in, and then it's going to inject that particular implementation of user. That's sort of the bigger picture over here. Now, there is a typical confusion between at resource and at inject. That, we already have at resource annotation in the Java EE platform. When do we use what? Typically, I've seen at resource being used for container managed dependency injection and at inject for application managed dependency injection. Although there are patterns in CDI where you don't have to use at resource injection at all. So the cool part about CDI is it gives you strong typing. So if you go back to our previous slide, here you're very clearly saying, I care about at logged in user and nothing else. That's a strong typing, but you still have a loose coupling because you're telling the CDI runtime to go figure out where this logged in user exists and inject it for me. It doesn't matter where you pick it from. This injection can happen at all different levels, and we saw the sample of at inject at logged in user, and here I'm saying at inject payment processor. So just inject some payment processor for me. It doesn't matter what type it is. Okay. And here I'm saying at inject set shopping cart. So in this method, inject the default bean or the default cart for me. So there are probably multiple implementations of cart, one of them being qualified as at default. So inject that one for me. You can do the injection in constructors as well. So at the constructor, you say at inject. And you have at logged in user, you have payment processor, and default cart. So two of them actually have qualifiers. Payment processor does not have a qualifier in this case. You can get a little bit fancy, wherein you start saying, okay, payment processor, I want to qualify it, make it a reliable payment processor, and you also have attributes to your qualifiers. You can say, I only want a payment processor that is reliable, and you can pay by credit card only. So the cool thing is, you know, how it is all of this is enabled. All you need to do is just have your empty beans.xml file as part of your application in the WebInf directory, and then it starts scanning which of the beans are available, and then it marks them as capable targets for injection. Now, let's say you have a bunch of beans, you can explicitly exclude them from resource injection as well. And beans.xml provides very fancy syntax on how it can do that. There is a lot more in CDI, you know, which we possibly can't cover because CDI itself is an hour-long topic. But this is just to kind of give you some food for thought. We made some good improvements in Java Server Faces as well. That's what I'm going to talk next. So, for example, Facelets is now being used as a templating language for the page. If you remember, Facelets uses simple XHTML and CSS for the view part of it. And it's simply the templating language. So what we're doing is we're using simple XHTML and CSS for creating the page. All of the back business logic exists in the backend bean. So let's take a look. This is a simple page. You have HTML element. You have your namespaces over here. You define a HTML head, then a body, then some header over here. You define you're defining a panel grid with some output text, input text, and then you have a backing bean over here, you know, in there. Now the cool thing is because this is plain HTML, it makes your creation of composite components much easier. So let's look at this panel grid, you know, one more time. So panel grid, columns two, output text, input text, and some error messages. Okay. Now the if you realize this code possibly can be used at multiple places within your website. So what we do is in NetBeans IDE 6.9, by the way, which provides extensive tooling for Java EE 6, you can select this code and you can say refactor convert to composite component. And this is going to convert into composite component. Let me show you what that means. So what it's going to do is it's going to, instead of the panel grid and all that big code over there, it's going to give me an easy colon username dash password. That is the name it's going to create. And in here, easy is mapped to javasuncom jsf composite. Now that is the standard namespace. And it adds easy comp. Okay. Let's see how that gets resolved. So what it do is it takes that code fragment that I showed earlier. If you go back here, so it takes this code fragment over here, puts it in a file username-password.xhtml. This becomes the tag name, which is being used over here. And easycomp is a directory, which is being appended to the standard namespace that I talked about earlier. So it's as simple as that. Now, and this is primarily possible because Facelift is the templating language. And we are just using standard XHTML and CSS techniques to achieve this. Another new feature that we've introduced in Java Superfaces is integrated support for AJAX. And it's available through a couple of ways. You know, we have, of course, F colon AJAX tag, which can, by the way, be embedded in any command button, any link, or anything that has can take an action. So here, let's take an example. I have a command button. The command button has an action listener, which says, you know, on click of this button, do this action. Okay. But instead, what I'm doing is in between, I'm putting a call called as F colon AJAX. So what it says, okay, instead of a full page refresh, just execute this AJAX call, take this as parameter, length as parameter. And once the return results from this bean and this method, refresh these two elements, actor table and total actors. So what will happen is the response, well, this is, what I've done is I've taken a MySQL sample database. I'm taking this parameter called as length. I'm passing the length parameter to the find actors method of Sakila bean. Sakila is a sample database. Then it takes the parameter length and it returns the number of actors which are whose first name is less than the characters defined by length. So once the result is returned, all I'm saying is refresh these two elements. So this is what we call as partial page refresh, and that's what AJAX is known for. So we return the result from the bean, and we do a partial page refresh or partial page rendering, so to say. So it allows you to achieve AJAX kind of functionality very easily. Some other improvements that I talked about earlier was, you know, faces.config.opxml, which is a default JSF deployment descriptor, is now optional in most of the common cases. For example, your managed bean element, you know, is being replaced by at managed bean or at named. At named is, by the way, defined by CDI. And CDI and JSF works very well with each other. Your validator, renderer, listener, all the different JSF concepts have equivalent annotations now. There are default navigation rules as well. So I think I have an example of default navigation rules in the next slide. But basically, you know, you have a simple bean, and then all you say is at named simple bean, and that becomes your JSF managed packing bean. And in terms of default navigation rule, so you have a command button, or action you say show, and value submit. So the idea is when you click on the button, the JSF runtime will look for a view by the name show dot xhtml. xhtml because we're using Facelift as a templating language. So it looks for show.xhtml. And so there's a default navigation rule. You no longer have to say from, to, and you know how it needs to look like. So the overall emphasis, overall focus in JSF has been simplification, excessive use of annotations, and convention over configuration. There's a lot more stuff that happens in JSF. Now it runs on Servlet 2.5, so it should run fine on Java EE5 container as well. There are conditional navigations available as well. So for example, you want to say from outcome to this page only if this condition is met. And foo.some condition is probably some method that returns a Boolean type in the backing being foo. There are project stages as well, you know, development, unit, system, production. So you can take actions based upon those project stages. And then there are bookmarkable URLs. So you can create URLs for your JSF pages that are actually bookmarkable, and you can revisit them again and again. All right, switching gears. So I'm going to go to Java Persistence API 2. This is another specification that got extreme makeover. The biggest focus over here has been, you know, sophisticated mapping and modeling options. And that's what I'm going to cover. And then another big change over here is the Criteria API, which is a type-safe way of writing Java persistence query language. So here, for example, you see a sample, you know, a Java model, a public class person. This is your social security number string, and this is marked as ID. Now, this is the standard JPA syntax so far, but what you see in the red is the new stuff. So, for example, you could have a set of string as a nickname, and this, you can say, belongs to a collection table. And this, you can also say, is an element collection. This was not possible earlier. Another one use case that you can do now is collection of embeddables. Now, if you see this class, public class address, street, city, state, this is marked as embeddable. Now, you can also say set of address. Instead of, you know, converting this into a string, you can say set of address. And here you're saying it's an element collection. So you can have a set of classes. So the idea is a much richer Java model now. Another example is multiple levels of embedding. So for example, you can see employee has contact info. And this is my contact info class. Contact info has address. Address could possibly have zip code as an embeddable class. So multiple levels of embedding is possible now. Another huge improvement is improved map support. Up until now, you could have a map with only integer as the primary key and anything else as a key value of it. But now, for example, you can see map. This is a map, this is a Java model, with movie as the primary key and integer as a value of it. And movie, as you can see, is an entity class. So that's possible now. In terms of Java persistence query language, several improvements have been made, and most of them are being focused towards the Java model changes. So for example, here you can look at it. You know, there is a, we have a case statement. So we're saying, okay, if the employee is doing good, give him money, now give him a raise. If he's not doing good, okay, I'll be back from him. Okay, so this is the Criteria API. This is a type-sized way of writing your persistence query language. So now the typical issue with JPQL or Java Persistence Query Language, the way you write queries in JPA, is they're all written in string. So there is no effective way to do checking at the compile time or at deployment time. It's only done at the runtime. So when your application is deployed, when it is executed, then you find, oh, you know what, my query is not right. Now with JPA Criteria API, it's so strongly typed that you know exactly what you are trying to fetch, what you're trying to get, what your criteria look like. So you can't even write an incorrect query. You get an error at the compile time itself. A lot more in JPA 2. For example, you can have a second level cache. First level cache is already done at the persistence entity or entity manager factory layer. You can explicitly on an entity class, you can put at cacheable annotation and then say, okay, you know what, I want this to be cached explicitly, and you can evict it out of a cache, and there are sophisticated APIs over there. There are new locking modes and some certain shared configuration options. All right, so talk about bean validation now. As I mentioned earlier, bean validation is a standard mechanism to define constraints for data validation. It comes in the javax.validation.star package. There are certain predefined validation constraints, such as act not now, what you can do is you can put these validation constraints as a part of your, is there a question? Okay. So you can put these validation constraints as part of your JSF managed beans or JPA beans or any beans. And then the idea is these are so tightly integrated with JSF and JPA that, for example, you put these constraints on a JSF backing bean, and then you use the backing bean to read some input value from a faceless form. Now, the moment you enter the data in there, say, if you put a constraint like at size max 30, okay, and then if you enter 31 characters in the input box, the JSF expression language resolver will kick in and it will say, uh-oh, you know what, your backing bean has a constraint on it which is not being matched, so it'll throw an error back. Similarly, if you put these constraints on a JPA bean, then it will say, okay, before I want to persist the element, I'm going to make sure the validation constraints are being met. And if they're not met, it throws an error back. And the cool part is, you know, there are a whole bunch of validation constraints that are predefined, but there is also a very good framework that is available to create your own constraints. So, for example, on a string recipient, you know, as shown in the last bullet, you can have your own constraint called as at email. Okay. All right, switching gears one more time, and we're going to talk about Java API for RESTful web services. Most of you folks are probably familiar with it because this has been existing the longest, actually before the Java EE6 platform became final, but we are including version 1.1 in the Java EE6 platform. This is a standard way of doing RESTful web services in the Java EE platform. It's purely POJO based, and I'll show some samples on what I really mean by that. Mostly server-side API, at least in 1.1, and it's HTTP centric because that's where we see most of the RESTful web services are working. So, for example, let's take a simple POJO class. This is a plain old Java class. It says public class hello world resource. It's got a say hello method and a morning method. Nothing fancy about it. You just sprinkle certain JAX-RS annotations in here. The first annotation you do is you put at path, saying this resource is available at slash hello world method or path. And then you say at get method. Basically what you're saying is whenever this resource is being accessed at using a HTTP get method, this is the method that gets executed, which produces text slash plain, and this is the result it produces. Now in between, you can inject a persistence context or entity manager, and you can do some database interaction, bring the value from there and return the value. That can be done very easily. This method says that, okay, this is the relative path on which this method will be invoked. So if somebody invokes slash hello world slash morning, then this method is going to get executed. That's the idea. You can actually explicitly specify output MIME type. You know, we were saying, for example, in the previous slide, we said MIME type for a method. Here you're specifying MIME type for the entire resource. And then, so for example, this one, do get as plain text method gets invoked when this resource is being accessed as HTTP get, using, and it returns text slash plain, but here you're overriding that I'm returning text slash HTML instead, but still HTTP get. Another example, you can have one method and you can have multiple produces MIME type. And so this method could behave depending upon what the client is requesting for. The client could have an accept method and saying, you know what, I want application slash XML, in which case this method returns XML. And the way this thing typically works is, you know, you could possibly have a JAXB bean, which knows how to seamlessly convert to XML or JSON data type. Here's a real life code sample that I wrote a sample application, and that is from there. Basically what we're doing is, you know, we're saying this is an actor resource, it's in the request scoped, and I'm injecting a database bean, which is doing my database functionality. And all it's saying is, you know, you give me an ID, and I'm gonna find the actor by that ID from the database bean. Now if I space out the method a little bit, and I add some annotations to it, then you can see this resource is now available at slash actor slash ID. Okay, this ID gets mapped to the parameter of this method. It's simple, add pass param. And then this ID is being fed to my database, and db.findActor by ID method gets executed, returns the TextDB bean, and returns the JSON data type. Now, all of this can be very easily done using servlets as well. Well, not easily. It takes quite a bit of effort, but the JAX-RS annotations makes it really simple for you to do all this logic. Just by putting certain annotations, all the mapping and everything is done for you. And just by changing the producer's type, you know, you could change it from application slash JSON to application slash XML, and then the method starts dumping out XML data type. In JAX-RS 1.1, well, not part of the specification, but Jersey, which is the implementation of JAX-RS, we have also added some client-side APIs. It's very easy to consume HTTP-based RESTful services. It's certainly much better than a simple HTTP URL connection where you have to produce the entire format or envelope by hand, and makes it much more bulky. This is a code sample of how the client-side API looks like. You can say client.create. You say what resource you want to access. You invoke the get method. And then, you know, you say, okay, I'm accepting only text slash plain, and then you invoke the method. And the get method can be easily replaced by put, post, and delete.
Arun?
Yes.
Sorry for interrupting. I just wanted to let you know we have about 4 minutes left in the hour, so
yeah.
I'm not quite sure how much more you want to go through and if people want to ask any questions.
Right. I think I'm going to skip through some slides and actually get to the roadmap now already.
Okay.
Yeah. So Glassfish, as I mentioned briefly, is a reference implementation for Java EE 6. And in terms of the Glassfish distributions that are available today, it really is, we have an open source version or called a Glassfish open source edition. The latest version is 3.0.1. It's dual license under Kerdel NGPL version 2. It has all of Java EE 6 compatibility, no clustering, although clustering is being planned for 3.1, but you can still use modjk for load balancing. However, if you want clustering today, then we can definitely recommend Glassfish open source edition 2.1.1. And both of these open source flavors have a commercial edition, which is basically Oracle Glassfish Server and the same version number. Okay, so that's one part of it. In terms of Glassfish 3, it's modular, embeddable, and extensible. It's fully OSGI, and we use OSGI for all runtime management. You can plug in any kind of container. You can run inside a VM. A lot more details in there. in terms of NetBeans, I would definitely encourage you to take a look at, actually, let me switch to my browser for a second. So this is a set of five screencasts that I've released about a couple of weeks back. You can click on the arrows over here. It'll show you the different screencasts that are available. And this shows in detail of all the samples that I wanted to show today. It shows you how to create a JSP servlet, EJB, JPA, JSF facelets, you know, context and dependency injection, RESTful web services, all of those samples in detail using NetBeans. And later today, I'm going to be releasing all of these screencasts using Eclipse as well. There are a whole bunch of books that are available on Java EE. This is mostly from the community, actually. Actually, all from the community, really. Glassfish 301, and this is the first Oracle-branded release of Glassfish. Extensive platform support. There is JRocket support as well, if you're interested. And in terms of Glassfish 3.1, where we are today, which is what we're working on today, the main features really are clustering and centralized administration. So you can have full-blown clustering over there, session failover, and things like that. And there's high availability, which is what the session failover part is. And we're building some cool features over there, such as application versioning, wherein you can take an application, you can deploy it on Glassfish, multiple versions of it, and not make it active. So changing a version of, deploying a new version of application does not take a lot of time. You can just switch from one version to different versions. They're all deployed concurrently. The web-based administration console is going to be based on the RESTful API. And in terms of broader Glassfish, Oracle is definitely committed to Glassfish community. It certainly remains transparent and participatory. We more than encourage you to take a look at it and tell us, you know, where you want us to go. Oracle definitely wants to grow the community, and it's primarily, you know, community-driven roadmap. And as you can see, 3.0.1 is already being released. 3.1 is being worked upon right now. There is a solid roadmap for next 2 years. So in terms of Glassfish and Java EE, Oracle is committed. We want to make it successful, and we want your help in making it successful. I'm going to leave you with some references. So glassfish.org is a website where you get all the details. You can go to blogs.com/theaquarium. We try to keep it, you know, current on a regular basis. You can go to glassfish.org/roadmap for all the details, and follow us on Twitter at Glassfish. So that pretty much concludes my fast-paced presentation. I'm more than open for any questions now.
Questions?
Hello, Vicky and Arun. This is Ron Bhatra. How are you doing?
Very well. Tell me.
Question. Will you be circulating this deck later on? So some of the concepts, especially Glashwick, are strategic to what we're doing. So just will you be sending this deck to all of us who attended?
Yes.
Or would that be?
So I will share this slide deck with Vicky, who can then share it forward.
Okay. And then we are, Oracle's okay about us blogging, Twittering, and that kind of stuff about it, right? You have no issues with the confidentiality of the material in this deck?
Everything in this slide deck is a public information. So by all means, we need your help in blogging, Twittering, and spreading the word forward.
Okay. I guess last question. Have people been asking you in deployment models, Glassfish as an alternate for WebLogic in low-cost deployment models, and in particular, not with custom Java development, but in environments like SOA Suite, have people been asking, has there been any interest around Glassfish being as one of the options for the application server instead of WebLogic with SOA Suite?
So I think each case, as I take it, is very, you know, dependent, you know, depending upon what you really want. So shoot me a mail, arun.p.gupta@oracle.com. We can talk more about it, and you know, I need to understand what your requirements and conditions are, and then we can recommend accordingly.
Okay. Thank you, Arun. And Vicky, that's all I
have. Thank you. So, yeah, I mean, we definitely need your help in spreading the word forward, telling people the benefits of Java EE 6, and if they are not convinced, I'm more than happy to come over and talk to your organizations and give a repeat of this presentation, either at this pace or at a much slower half a day pace. I've conducted many Java EE 6 hands-on workshops. I did one in Dallas last week. We're doing in San Francisco in a couple of weeks. There are many more that are getting planned. So if you are interested in either a Java EE 6 hands-on workshop or, you know, just a presentation like this, that can very easily be arranged for anybody.
Cool.
Great. Okay, well, I'm going to turn off the recording, and if anyone comes up with any last-minute questions, feel free to contact me. I can pass you through to Arun, or I'll also post the slides, and I think he said his email address is arun.p.gupta@oracle.com, but either way, we can get you in touch, and thank you very much, Arun.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Arun.
Bye-bye.